You're listening to the Full and Thriving Podcast, a place where courageous women come to break free from food obsession, heal their relationship with their body, and strive to live a life that's present, lighthearted, and meaningful. If you're listening, my wish is that this podcast serves as a catalyst that inspires you to nourish your body, nurture your mind, and energize your spirit. I'm your host, Meg McCabe, a certified life coach and eating disorder recovery coach with a PhD in having a good time. Just kidding about that last part. Anyway, thank you so much for listening and enjoy the show. Today's guest is Stephanie Roth Goldberg. Stephanie is the founder of the Intuitive Psychotherapy New York City and is an interactive psychodynamic psychotherapist and psychoanalyst. She specializes in working with athletes and the intersection of eating disorders, as well as helping people heal their relationship with their bodies and exercise. In this episode, Stephanie and I talk about recovery for athletes and dive deeper into sports, recovery, excessive exercise, and the common challenges that athletes face when healing their eating disorder. I know that you are absolutely going to find this episode of the show super interesting. All right, with that, I hope you enjoy this episode of the show. Hi, Stephanie. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are things over in New York?
Good. I'm at my New Jersey office right now, but same thing. It's windy here, but good.
Good. It's so windy over here today. It was freezing when I went on a little walk outside. So I'm glad to be back cozy into my little recording studio right now and talking to you. It's a much more warmer situation over here now. So I'm just so excited to be talking to you today because I feel like athletes have so many questions about eating disorder recovery. And I think you are the perfect person to talk to when it comes to this. So I would love to start off by asking you, what is your passion and purpose as a psychotherapist?
That's a great question. I specialize in eating disorders, and I am very passionate about helping people recover from an eating disorder from an anti-diet food freedom lens. However, my real love and passion is working with athletes or even folks who aren't necessarily quote unquote athletes, but really love exercise and moving their bodies and helping them develop a healthy relationship with both their body and food and their sport. I would say that's definitely my passion.
And you're an athlete yourself, correct?
Yeah, I'm mostly a runner at the moment while my kids are quite young, but I am a triathlete. I can't wait for my kids to be bit older so I can go on some longer bike rides as well.
Oh, that sounds really cool. Are you planning on getting them into sports?
Yeah, my five-year-old was riding his bike probably before most kids he knew. And we do a lot of family like fun runs together.
Oh, I love that. That sounds really cool. I always see families like in my neighborhood, just like a dad and his little son running around, or like athletics is really a big thing in the town I grew up in. So it's really cool when I see like little kids following their parents, like little athletic passions, you know?
Yeah.
Awesome. So I'm wondering if you could dive into a little bit about how food has impacted your performance as an athlete.
The way I actually found intuitive eating was during an Ironman training cycle. I was already practicing as a psychotherapist, eating disorder specialist, and I was just so tired all the time and having a really hard time managing what I thought I should be eating and how I thought I should be eating. And I had the book on my bookshelf in my office for, I don't know how long, but a long time. And I laid down to take a nap and I couldn't sleep. And I just like, for some reason, that book, I felt like it was staring at me from the bookshelf. And I read it and it sort of immediately clicked, probably because I was already working as an eating disorder therapist. And I called up a friend of mine who's a sports dietitian. And I was like, what do you think about this for people who are really training and doing a lot of training and a lot of impact on their body? And we talked through it a little. And I was like, all right, I'm going to go through this book as it's laid out and see if I can do it. And I would say that was one of the best seasons up until that time that I had, because I let myself eat more frequently and I was less concerned about timing in some ways, which is not true, let me say, while in movement, in motion, on a run, on a bike, any long endurance sports, you do have to actually eat when you're not hungry at certain intervals. But yeah, and so then I got certified in it and here I am.
Wow. Okay. So can you explain the difference for you in your experience of before intuitive eating and after? Like, what was that like from a performance perspective? How did you feel in your body?
I just felt more energy. And I think I want to say I felt more stable throughout the day in terms of, like, I was pretty strict about when I should eat because I was just coming off of a swim or going to here and going to there. And so I was always calculating how long it is until my next training session. And as a therapist, it can be hard, depending on how I was scheduling my day, to get in enough food. And so I thought to myself, like, okay, actually, I'm going to bring a smoothie to work and see if I can drink it while in session even. And that helps a lot. I was like, oh, I'm not starving all the time. And so it was just really honoring my hunger and being a little more flexible with what I thought I could or couldn't do, whether that was because of my job or a variety of other things. So I think I felt more even and more energy almost immediately.
That's so nice. I feel like many people can relate when they finally start to nourish their body properly. The feeling is a transformative feeling. And I'm glad that you were able to experience that within your body right away.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so awesome. So there's this, I don't even know if, I guess it's a diagnosis in the field called relative energy deficiency in sports, REDS.
Yes. Dot,
yeah. And I see this around and I know generally about it, but I'd love it if you could explain what that is and how that relates to eating disorders.
Yeah. So REDS S used to just be called the female triad. And what the female triad was is amenorrhea, eating disorders, and stress fractures in body. And they changed it from the female triad because men also experience relative energy deficiency, and it's a little more generalized, which is helpful because more people can seek and get treatment and get diagnosis than having to be sort of further on the spectrum. It's an energy imbalance, let's say, when the body is not taking in enough energy to meet the demands that someone is placing on it. And oftentimes that translates to not eating enough food while participating in intensive exercise. And the warning signs for females, it can be easier to diagnose because one of the major warning signs is a disruption in menstrual cycle, whether that you stop getting your period or that it becomes irregular if it was regular prior. And testosterone levels being low can be harder to diagnose or recognize. But that absolutely happens to men. But the other, let's say, like, glaring symptoms or signs are mood swings, a loss of performance, a loss of motivation, gastrointestinal problems, significant weight loss. And then stress fractures are a big warning sign, particularly if there's multiple stress fractures, because it speaks to bone loss, which happens or is part of the diagnosis of REDS S.
Okay, that's just making me think back to high school. You know, I was a high school varsity athlete, and I remember I was on the swim team. I had an eating disorder, so I also lost my period. And then I felt like a lot of my friends had some sort of disordered eating. We didn't overtly talk about it, but I remember that there were folks on the cross-country team who would just perpetually get injured and have fractures. And then the doctor would tell them, oh, you need to stop running for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever, 6 weeks. I don't remember how long it was. And they would never actually wait that long. And then they'd re-injure themselves. And I think it could have been related to something that you're talking about. I don't know if that kind of something in your practice.
Yeah. And I think especially in previous decades, the loss of a period was something women or girls believed to mean that they were super fit. And people would talk about that. And I think in sports such as running, dancers also is a big one. I think swimming as well, actually. Yeah. But it wasn't something that people recognized quite as much.
Oh, yeah. I went to high school in the mid-2000s, essentially. Mid to late 2000s. And I just remember telling the doctor I didn't have my period. And they're like, oh, yeah, a lot of athletes don't really get their period. You're fine.
Right.
It was like their door to ask, hey, what's your relationship with food like? Are you nourishing your body? There was no discussion. Like, the eating disorder just went under the radar for several years because doctors weren't asking that or even aware that could be a problem.
And I imagine there's plenty of doctors who still would have the same answer, but hopefully there's many more who are more educated now.
Hopefully, yeah. Okay, so what happens when a person's like muscles don't get the sufficient fuel that they need? Because as an athlete, you're undernourishing yourself. What's that impact on your body, really, and your muscles in general?
The impact speaks back to Red's S, if it gets that far, like just an imbalance in your whole system, your endocrine system. And so recurrent injury of any kind can also be a warning sign that something is going on, some under eating. With muscles, it's hard. Like, you could strain a muscle, you could pull a muscle, but you're also weakening. You're not gaining strength. And a lot of times people recognize first a drop in performance because you just don't have the energy to do what you are asking your body to do.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. This is totally an abstract question, but I'm trying to put myself in the frame, like the mindset of an athlete with an eating disorder whose performance is dropping because they're undernourished. Is there a point where they don't care about the performance anymore? Or does the performance motivate getting better? Like, what do you tend to see?
I see both. I think it really varies because as you were talking, I was thinking this is a lot of where body image comes into play. Many athletes prefer their sport, or let's say if they're professionals or they're on college scholarships, which I work with a lot, sometimes that's less of a choice almost. If you need to maintain your sport to maintain your scholarship, performance drops could be a big deal. But a lot of times this is where the battle with body image and desire to be an athlete or feed yourself enough comes into play, like exactly at this intersection, I would say.
Okay, that's interesting. So this is where the values and the priorities lead the way and which path you're going to take. Are you going to choose performance or body image looks?
Right.
Because that could be different. I remember just bringing it back, and feel free to chime in with your experience. But when I was in high school, I was trying to be like petite and thin. I could care less about my performance as a swimmer. Unfortunately, I did the bare minimum and I cared enough to be competitive, but I was exactly where my body image was the priority there. And I actually look back and I feel a lot of regret that I didn't want to go to the gym more and lift a little to improve my swimming, or I just wanted to have that specific look. And you're right. I feel like that crossroads kind of determines where people go. So you would say the folks who struggle are the ones who are torn with the body image problems.
I think that becomes a little bit harder because I always explain it as there's a tug of war going on. Like, they want to make some changes, but also their body image or eating disorder is quite strong. And so that's pulling them in a different direction of the motivation to eat. I also think, as you were talking, I was thinking sometimes people don't recognize this is body image because they think they need to look a certain way to perform a certain way. And breaking that down is really difficult. I was definitely someone who really thought that being thinner would make me a better runner. And so it can be a challenge to really undo those long-standing beliefs.
That's really interesting. I see that with running a lot. Like, I feel like there is that image of this quote, idealized image of what a endurance runner looks, and especially for women, I think, and men too. And so challenging that would be huge. I feel like I was really lucky because when I was on the swim team, many of the girls in larger bodies were the best swimmers. I guess I had proof in front of me that thinness didn't correlate with success necessarily.
And it sounds like you were an example of.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting that this is bringing up some like past experiences with swimming in high school. I just do definitely wish I prioritized performance a little more. But I guess you're right. Those eating disorder was just too strong during that time.
The other thing that can happen a lot, I do, by the way, love a good podcast turned into pseudotherapy session. So
this has been happening a few times recently. So I'm just really learning about myself lately.
But the other thing that, as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, particularly with younger teens in high school, it can also be that you get praised more for your body than performance, which is another complicating factor for a lot of people.
Yes. Yeah. I know that, or I believe that my value was more rooted in my appearance than rooted in my performance. Like I saw my worth more connected to my appearance than my performance. You know, one question that a lot of my clients have when they are athletes or they have excessive exercise as a behavior, sometimes there's a point where they need to stop their movement and activity in sport in order to recover. So I'm really curious from your professional opinion, when would the right time for a person to stop moving? When is that necessary?
Before I answer that, I want to say one thing because you were talking about excessive exercise and sport, and I'm probably going to get this not exactly right, but you said something like they have to stop movement. And this is where I really like to distinguish movement from exercise.
Okay. Yes.
Because sometimes it can be helpful to have a little movement when you have to stop exercising in any sort of way that is more defined, whether it's by length, by distance, by classes that one might be taking. But allowing some movement in can be helpful for that buy-in for people. At least that's my philosophy on the language.
I'm actually with you on that, but I'd love to hear more, but keep going.
I think, you know, there's many times where people, where it's helpful or necessary for people to stop. So the most necessary would be someone who's continuing to exercise or train or whatever through an injury, that your body can't really give you any different signals than that, that you're doing too much and you need some rest and you need help recovering from whatever the said injury is. Not to say that people, you know, if you had something going on with your foot, you couldn't swim without kicking your legs for some movement, but that hard training can be difficult. Although this is also where we have to distinguish between somewhat of an elite or professional athlete versus someone who really, like myself, like really loves participating in sport, but it is not something that is necessary for me to do in terms of my living. So I think that's an important distinction too. All the things we said when we were talking about Red's S, those are all the signs, right? When you're really not motivated and you keep pushing yourself, one of the best ways to get re-motivated is to take some time off. When your body is aching, when your mood really shifts on a downward way. I think any significant weight loss also, regardless of what size body anyone is in, but significant weight loss can be a sign. And I think when it becomes something that like rules your life, when you would rather go to the gym than do anything else, that can be a sign that it's really too excessive.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think of the folks who are going to the gym at 4:30 in the morning, whether they have had enough sleep or not, or they go outside for a run when it's raining outside because they're going to beat themselves up if they don't do that. There's this, I think, a little drill sergeant inside their head.
Yeah. Although to be fair, that can be a hard one too. Like if someone is on a training program, running in the rain is not the worst thing. But I think to your point, it's what's the motivation? Am I going to beat myself up or is it because this is what I plan to do? Some people love running in the rain, that kind of thing. And the same thing, like it could be okay to go to the gym at 4:30 in the morning, but not if you didn't prioritize sleep.
Yeah. I guess I'm thinking about the person who's not on a training program, excessively going at movement for the sake of burning calories or for the sake of listening to their eating disorder.
It's that sentence you said of, for the person who's going to beat themselves up. Like that is a telltale sign that relationship is not a healthy one.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess you mentioned, so we're talking about signs you should probably pull back from exercise, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe keep a little movement in there. What sort of movement is appropriate for someone who has an active eating disorder, has decided an exercise is triggering for them, what movement is appropriate from your perspective?
This can be really individualized because what we were just talking about, it can often depend on one's relationship to said movement, right? So if someone was obsessively doing yoga, the way we were just talking about running, yoga, even the most gentle yoga, would probably not be a good movement. But for someone who really wasn't doing yoga and they can find, I think it's called yin yoga, where it's really relaxing, that can be a really good way to feel like, okay, I'm moving my body, I can be in touch with my body in a way that feels good, and I'm not doing anything too strenuous. Walking is another one. I have had clients who walk, but then it turns out they're walking 5 miles instead of that 10 minutes to get sunshine and get a little different environment and just that little bit of movement. So it varies based on where someone is at and what someone's relationship to the specific movement is.
You know, while you're talking, I was thinking about some clients I have who excessively move and exercise. So they're the type who might go for a walk and it turns into a 5 mile walk. And there's a part of them excessively moving, like almost needing to move nonstop throughout the day. Resting is a giant fear almost. So I don't know if you're getting the profile of a person I might be thinking about. Like, how do you go from being that person, right? The person where rest is scary, to like being able to be still? And like from a therapy lens almost, how would you approach that?
Often my first question is like, what are you running from? What happens when you still your body? What emotions come up? What thoughts? Because constant movement is also a way in which we just avoid other thoughts or sensations. A lot of people constantly move sometimes are actually just avoiding the fact that like when they slow down, their leg hurts or something. And some are avoiding other stressors, whatever those might be. And they have a really hard time sitting with their emotions, so they move. And then there's the fear of, then there's like other folks, and the sort of profile there is like the fear of losing fitness that's completely irrational. And often they know it's irrational. And I think that's where you treat it more like an eating disorder, even though excessive exercise is not a diagnostic criteria in any eating disorder.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So there's usually some sort of avoidance going on if resting is really hard.
Yeah, often there is.
Yeah, that sounds quite accurate. And I hope people listening are checking in with themselves about if that's what might come up if you decide to rest. Like, how does that make you feel? What thoughts and emotions come up? All of that, something to reflect on for sure.
And what can you do when you're resting? That's the other thing I say to people. It's not like you have to sit on your bed in total silence and not move, right? Like, you can find something that you want to do that day and do it.
Yeah. Well, tell me about that. Like, on days for you where you're resting, what do you like to do?
It's so funny as a mom, like what I think of as a rest day is so different than what I would love to say to you is like, oh, I binge watch TV and watch a movie. And that rarely happens unless it's like a Disney movie. But what I do like to do is sleep in a bit more and try and do some kind of like fun breakfast. Like maybe we all go out as a family to eat breakfast or something, because typically I'm an early riser and then it's a little bit rushed to get to my kids' activities by the time I'm home. So I like to do that or sit in the bed and watch a show kind of thing together. But my rest days are definitely less restful than I would like them to be.
Yeah, that sounds like a challenge, being a mom and finding time to rest. I'm sure there's so many people listening who totally get what you're saying. I feel like you pointing out that rest doesn't have to just look like doing nothing all day in your bed. It can actually be like sitting and watching a movie or reading a book or journaling or writing a blog or whatever you like to do. It's just taking some time to be still.
Yeah. Or even like one of my favorite things used to be, and still somewhat, is to make a recipe that I might not otherwise have time for that takes longer, like usually baking something. Because I can, you know, watch an hour of TV while it's in the oven or whatever, and my whole day is less crunched.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds really nice. I need to do some baking. I haven't done any baking in so long. Like, I'm more into cooking like dishes right now, but I should switch it up and go back to baking.
I should do more cooking. So I guess it's always one or the other.
We all, I flip-flop. I definitely flip-flop. But anyway, okay, very interesting. So we have the folks who have trouble with rest, and we're talking about the importance of rest. What do you think happens to an athlete who doesn't rest? What is the impact that not resting could have on a person?
You know, it's interesting. Some people really can go a long time without a rest. They just really don't need it. And that's the way their body is. I often find people who were like collegiate athletes who were so used to always training hours and hours can, this is by no means scientific, by the way, but like can go a bit longer than I need rest every single week. I take at least one rest day a week. It depends. But I think for a lot of people, it does get to that point of you're fatigued, your muscles are fatigued. And so you're doing more harm than good because you're not giving yourself time to recover. I think that's a major one.
How do you like to think of rest as an athlete?
I have read many times a quote that says something like, if you're training hard enough, you look forward to a rest day. And that's maybe not the best way to look at it. But for me, I'm like, oh, I am really excited to sleep. And I feel really good about right now I'm training for a half marathon. And so my Saturdays are quite speedy and taxing. And then I'm like so excited to sleep a little and use my Theragun. And so I think of it like that. Like I really believe that my muscles are recovering in those days.
Mm-hmm. It also sounds like almost a little reward for you at the end of a hard week of training.
Right.
So when people are finally like maybe they've stopped exercise and they're actively working on recovery, they're getting stronger in recovery. At what point would you think it would be safe for someone to return to exercise?
One of my favorite exercises to do with folks in that position is to sort of do what I call a red light, yellow light, green light, writing down the exercises that might feel more triggering to them. So if someone, let's say, was a swimmer competitively in that whole scene, felt triggering to them, that would go under the red light category, right? But like a green light could be taking a yoga class or taking a spin class or a dance class. And so I think exercise can be reintroduced in a way that someone is more mindful and intentional about and is like assessing constantly, which I think is helpful, and trying to find what do I actually like to do? Because a lot of times people have been doing things for years obsessively, and then they take a little break and they're like, I don't know if I really like this.
Yes, I actually was talking to someone about that this week. I was like, maybe you're not really a cross-country runner anymore. Now that you've gone through recovery, maybe that's not part of your identity anymore. What might you be now?
And what did they say?
Honestly, it was a very interesting conversation because the more we discussed it, there was this unpacking of, you know, I might not actually identify as cross-country runner anymore. And there's some complicating factors like husband is a cross-country runner. They met in college, being runners. We also discussed maybe it's not your identity to be that cross-country runner anymore, but maybe you're just a supportive partner who likes to do running with your husband once in a while, right? So it's a little bit different. So it was an interesting conversation. We did not establish like any new form of movement that she might more closely identify with, though. I think it's an exploratory process from here. We're just letting her return to running and we're trying to see and observe this week, like what comes up, if any disordered thoughts come back up or anything like body image thoughts, old things. We're just going to observe and adjust depending on what we see.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned the identity piece because I think that can be a really hard thing for a lot of people in admitting, maybe I don't like this anymore, even though it feels like a big part of my identity.
Yeah, I think identity is a big part with competitive athletes. Do you do any work with your clients around identity? And
yeah, I do. I do a lot of like a pie chart of what are all the things that make up my identity? What does it look like now? And a lot of times, one of the biggest pieces of the pie would be their sport. And what do ideally I want it to look like? It can be a really good way to also recognize that your identity is made up much more than your sport. But oftentimes people are very caught up in that. And that could be also tricky in talking to some folks like, that's what I'm known as. I'm known as the friend who is a cross-country runner or whatever. And getting them to understand, like, even if people think of them that way, that's not why they keep them in their life. So untangling identity is like a big part of yeah. work that I do.
Okay, so what do you do if someone's identity is really entrenched in like a triggering sport to them? Like, how do you pull that apart? You know, what happens?
I'm a believer in like, it doesn't have to not be your identity. It's still part of who you are. It's still part of your story. So I think allowing people to recognize that, okay, so to use your client's example, like you're retiring from cross-country running, but that doesn't mean you weren't a cross-country runner. And I think a lot of times when people are allowed or give themselves the freedom to think about what else they want to be doing, it can be also a really helpful buy-in of, okay, this feels like your identity, but you're not even sure you want that to be your identity. What do you want your identity to be? What other parts of you do you want to lead with and think about?
Yeah, that can be so helpful. I also hear so many identities related to, I'm the one who eats clean, or I'm the vegan athlete. And so the food becomes part of the identity too.
Totally.
Yeah. So just back to my original question about returning. Like, what are the signs that someone's healed enough to get back to their sport?
One of the main signs I think of is how obsessed they are with it or not. Like, in a way that sometimes our body can crave movement that feels really good, right? Oh, I really want to go and ride my bike, as opposed to I need to ride my bike because I'm having an emotional day and that's the only thing that makes me feel better. So that emotional relationship with it can be big. And I think to kind of piggyback off what we were just saying, like how much of one's identity they're tying and wrapping up into that idea of this is who I am and how closely related is food. Because another big thing is a lot of people feel that they are recovered when they're eating enough. And then really they only eat around like their soccer game or their long run, and they eat before and after. And then that's it. And the only way they give themselves permission to eat is by exercising.
Yeah.
So untangling that is a big thing too.
Yeah, that's a really big one. Almost the earn your food mentality that people get stuck in, especially athletes. So essentially checking in with yourself in an honest way, like, am I nourishing myself enough on the days I'm not exercising would be important.
And how much am I thinking about exercise in relation to food? Can I separate those two completely?
Yep. Okay. So that's really helpful to think about. Any other ideas related to returning?
I think it depends, again, like what someone's level of what we're referring to as athletes is. But if someone has the freedom and flexibility to explore other exercise modalities, I think that can be healthy too. And another big one is like, how else are they managing their emotions? A lot of times people who excessively exercise or use that as their primary emotional outlet, which can be really unhealthy.
That's a really good one too. So recognizing whether or not you're leaning on that as your only coping tool, whereas have you learned other tools to cope with your emotions? That's a big one. I'm glad you pointed that out.
Yeah.
Did you, as an adult, you mentioned like discovering new things, and we're coming to the end of the interview, so I'm really curious. As an adult who's had a lived experience with an eating disorder, I assume your relationship with movement's healed and healthy now. Did you ever rediscover a sport older that you hadn't tried before? Because I know that's one of my joys as an adult now is exploring new forms of movement. Like, I love skiing. I didn't pick up skiing till I was like 28. And what else? I picked up cycle bar later. So I'm just curious to know if you've had some discovery like beyond just the sports you do.
I'm recently playing tennis. I played tennis as a kid. It's funny, yes, we're talking about this. I'm really not that coordinated. So the sports that I want to do end up like tennis. It's really difficult for me. So I am playing tennis now, but really socially. And therefore, I'm like playing more than I would. But it's like a great way to hang out. My husband and I like to go together for a tennis date. And so that is something I feel like I can give myself permission to just know that I'm pretty awful at and have fun with. And I would say that's the big thing for me, is that I'm not going to be great at everything, and I can accept that now.
Yeah.
So it allows me to re-explore some sports that I had written off, such as tennis.
That's such a transformation as a person, right? To not approach new things because you're worried you're not going to be the best at it.
Right.
And then working to accept, hey, I'm learning this. I'm going to suck at tennis, but it's fun and it's social for me. I can do it with my husband. And it is what it is. Like, I'm not trying to become this competitive tennis player.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I love that mindset. I always have fun. Like, the learner's mind is such a gift when it comes to exploring new sports. So that's a really helpful reminder to end on. But before I let you go, Stephanie, do you have any final words of wisdom to the athletes listening today who are struggling with an eating disorder?
Yeah, one of my biggest words of wisdom to folks who are unsure is if you are thinking and debating whether you have disordered eating or an eating disorder, the likelihood is that you do. And if you don't, you're not sure, it's a perfect time to seek professional help before it gets worse. And if you love your sport, it's helpful to get ahead of that so that you don't have to go into early retirement, if you will, so that you can prevent injuries. Say, like, if you are even considering this as an idea, seek professional help. It's never too early.
Yeah, I like that reframe in a way of getting early help can protect your sport. Yeah, it can protect you as an athlete so that things don't get worse and you have to retire early. If you want to do this for a lifetime, it makes sense to get the treatment you need now.
Right.
I love that. Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me and the listeners today. Where can everyone find you if they want to get in touch with you?
Probably the easiest place is on Instagram at Embodied Psychotherapist. My website is Intuitive Psychotherapy NYC. And my New Jersey practice is called Spring Psychotherapy and Wellness.
Fabulous. Thanks again, Stephanie. It's been a pleasure. And I hope you have a beautiful day.
Thanks. You too.